This is Michael Cathcart on Books and Arts on RN. Do stay with me now because we're heading to San Francisco in the 60s at a time when the Beat Poets were being joined by the new spirit of flower power. If you're going to San Francisco, yes, we're going to San Francisco, but we're going there via the Melbourne suburb of Armidale. You'll find lots of galleries and antique shops. And I've had a tip-off. A friend of mine, an art conservator, rang to tell me that a commercial gallery is showing an extraordinary collection of paintings from San Francisco, paintings from the Beat and Flower Power period of the 1960s. So how have these incredible paintings ended up in an Australian suburb? Well, the collection belongs to a 90-year-old American, Dr. Michael Agron. He was a psychiatrist in San Francisco in the 1950s and 60s, and for a while he was engaged in research into the use of LSD as a therapeutic drug, and then he became deeply involved in the art scene. Yes, it's a story with everything: drugs, Beat Poets, and art. So let's head there now and meet the collector and the gallery owner, Tony Lack. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Michael.
And Dr. Michael Agron, nice to have you on the program.
Hi, thank you.
You became an art collector by a very unusual route. You're a psychiatric doctor working in the US Navy at the end of the Second World War. What did you take away from that time?
I like the discipline. But there's something in the Navy that I like more than being in the Army. It had a nicer feel to me. And I think deep down there's a love of the sea, which maybe in some other existence I can explore.
So you left the Navy, and then this journey really begins when you go to the University of California, where you're involved in the use of LSD as a drug for treating mental illness. Can you tell us about that work?
After I left the Navy, I had a practice in Palo Alto, which is just south of San Francisco. I did various kinds of psychiatry, and then while teaching as an associate professor at the University of California Medical School in San Francisco, where I was for about 8 years, I encountered a then medical student just by chance. And he was absolutely brilliant person. His name was Dr. Sterling Bunnell, who had just come back from about a year with the Indians in the Amazon. He had grown up in San Francisco. He did introduce me to a number of the people in the San Francisco area, like Gary Snyder and several others, Snyder the poet.
Is it true to say that your research with drugs like LSD that affect people's state of mind was one of the factors that opened you up to the creative potential of the human mind?
No, I was aware of that before, and that always interested me. And by that time, my psychiatric practice is sort of pared down to creative people. So I was really ready for the San Francisco scene when I came upon it. But while at the university, I did do with Dr. Bunnell research on hallucinogenic drugs. The drugs were supplied by pharmaceutical companies. At that time, they were not illegal, and the pharmaceutical companies wanted to know if there was a way to use them in psychiatry or psychotherapeutically. So we studied a number of those drugs, found indeed that they're profoundly useful if properly used, and that's a big if, because you've got to be really well trained to know just where you are in the state of minds to help the person in the drug state. And once you start working at that level with these substances, your appreciation of the depths and extent of the human being, the human consciousness, is just mind-staggering. And so my interest in art, these people, many of them you see on the walls here, were people who were unafraid to go into their own greatest depths, and they had the technical skill in art to paint and draw what they found deep inside themselves. So that most of these works have enormous depth and if one lives with them or looks at them for a long time, one goes deeper and deeper and deeper into many, many levels that are at first not apparent.
So tell us, Michael, what happened that brought you into the position of being a man who owned the gallery?
Slowly, slowly, gradually, these beat-tippy creative people, artists, painters, poets, were inviting me into their circles. It was very subtle, but they did it over time. And so I got to know a lot of them. And when I knew about the Batman Gallery as originally founded, but when that time owner had to close it, it was available for sale. And Dave Hazelwood, the publisher of the Auerhahn Press, one of the famous publishers and poets at the time, told me about it, that it was available, and urged me to buy it if possible, which I did. And together with my wife, we ran it for another 3 years until expenses and rents got too high. I never did give up psychiatric practice while in the gallery. I had to have a day job, and so I continued my psychiatric work.
Now, up on the wall above your head, there's a sign that says Batman 2222, 2222 Fillmore Street. So I guess that was your address. Who were some of the people who gathered at 2222 Fillmore Street?
Most everybody in the beat scene in San Francisco. Certainly Connor, McClure, Ferlinghetti, Brenneman, Snyder. There's a long list, and it was sort of a hangout. It was their space, and they came and met and talked. And Allen Ginsberg, the poet, used to love to drop in, and he would like to play his concertina and sing his mantras, and he used to enjoy that tremendously.
You're listening to Books and Arts Daily with Michael Cathcart, and I'm talking to Mike Agron, art collector, and to Tony Lack, who runs the Ecliptic Gallery, where Mike's lifetime of collecting is on show because it is for sale. So we're sitting now far from California. We're sitting in a suburban gallery in Melbourne, in a Well Hill suburb of Melbourne. You're surrounded by these pictures that you know so well. Perhaps we should just look at a couple. I suppose the most striking picture in the room is directly in front of us. It's called Crucifixion, and it's a large painting. It's about 2 metres square. It's just the groin, really, of what could be a Christ figure.
The torso and the groin. The thing about that, I bought that painting at the same time I bought the gallery. It's a very powerful painting. The painter, Bruce Conner, was a quietly, deeply spiritual man and felt, as so many of us do, the horrible things that had been done both to Jesus the man and to Jesus' teachings, the way they were torn apart and ripped asunder by in the thousands of years that have passed. And Conner felt that deeply. His painting is a very powerful portrayal of that, and I was drawn to that because the spiritual side of humans is extremely important and integrates with every other aspect of their being and their creativity. And their...
Tony Lack, you make big claims for this picture.
Yes, Michael. I think this is probably one of the most significant paintings by an American artist in Australia today. It ranks along with the works of Pollock, Rothko, Warhol, and in fact, some commentators have indicated that Bruce Conner, the artist, will become one of the most influential artists on the west coast of the United States. I think it's also significant that there is another painting as well as Crucifixion, which is called Floating Head, which is lesser recognised than Crucifixion. As Crucifixion was recognised in 1968 by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art as being one of the cornerstone pieces of the genius of Bruce Conner.
I mean, I suppose I need to take what you're saying with a pinch of salt, because you are a gallery owner who's trying to sell these paintings, so of course you're going to tell me they're terribly significant, but they are clearly very powerful works.
There's no doubt about the fact that I'm trying to ensure that the whole collection, which includes crucifixion and floating head, are properly recognised by appropriate institutions. The reality is that Mike, over his career, has developed this huge collection of works, which includes sculpture, collage, assemblage, and all sorts of photographs of the shows that were held at the Batman, as well as tape recordings of poetry readings which were held at Fillmore Street, at Monterey and Big Sur. By the most avant-garde artists of the day.
Just as we're sitting here, we are surrounded by an extraordinary array of works, from these two very powerful paintings we've just been talking about, to little abstract paintings, quite random works, to some beautiful collages. There's some very striking portraits. In fact, Michael, the portrait that's directly behind you, which is in khaki, which is of a man who looks as though he's in some kind of psychic distress, actually. He's clawing at his chest and he's got a finger in his mouth. That's a very powerful work. Can you tell me about that?
It's extremely powerful. That's a self-portrait by Robert Brenneman. Robert Brenneman is a very good painter, and we have many of his works, and they're intensely beautiful. Although, like others of that the gallery had, they go off into their own spaces, which are vast and endless, and they bring them to us so we could see them. But Brandeman's painting sort of shows the human condition very powerfully, and that's why everybody resonates with it, his self-portrait, that is. There's somebody there in Brandeman, as you see, and somebody there is looking out at the world and is awed by it, is overwhelmed by it, and you can see his sort of fear of the world that... all of us actually feel that anxiety about what's there. But at the same time, he retains a sense of humor, and he's doing a bit of spoofing.
When you say that, he could be just putting this on. He could be acting up for the mirror.
Exactly. He could be spoofing his public. What I like to collect is people whose work was really on many, many, many levels and depths. And so he's there, but he's also a scared young man. But he's got his sense of humor, and he's putting us on and so on.
If Tony said, look, I've got rid of the lot, but the new buyer would like you to take one back for your own collection, which one would you take?
Crucifixion. It is one of the most powerful statements about mankind overall, about humans, human civilization, and what they do when they're offered... A divine possibilities of living with each other and loving each other and so on, but what people end up really, really doing to one another. It is overwhelmingly powerful. So I like that. Floating head is in a whole other domain. It's the mind in space. Nothing is yet concrete. And cosmic consciousness is just floating there in the void.
So it's a very, very dark painting in which the use of the paint on the canvas is almost sculptural. It's as if a great black wave is kind of rising up in a dark cosmos. And in the distance, we can see what could be a moon, but what could also be a face gazing down on, I guess, what might be the first act of creation. But what that creation will become, it's impossible to tell because everything is still expressing itself as darkness and energy.
Michael, I think there's probably another explanation of both of the paintings, and it goes back to what was happening when they were painted, which was in 1956 and 57. 50 million people had died in the Second World War, with some of the most despicable acts of human history, atom bombs, death camps. In the Korean War, there'd been a further 3 million people perish. In 1956, the first satellite was launched. Everybody was vulnerable. And there were a lot of people who were looking for something better. The Beats were looking for something better. The hippies were looking for something better. It was, let's establish a new culture, a counterculture. And so a lot of those forces were there. And when you look at Floating Head and when you look at Crucifixion, I think they're as much a commentary about where humanity had got to with so many major catastrophic events in the world And these artists were saying, let's look at the world in a new way.
Now, you're offering this collection for sale. Will the collection be broken up, or do you expect to find a buyer for the whole collection?
I believe that the collection is an absolutely central and important part of the art history of California and San Francisco in particular. Its worth is far greater than the sum of its parts. You could sell off bits and pieces and there would be people who would buy them. But in terms of the whole collection, in terms of the history of California, the scholarship that's associated with it, because let's face it, the 1960s were a period of rapid social change. Civil rights, equal rights for women, gay rights, academic freedom, all of those things were there. And from those 1960s, we've had enormous strides made in by humanity and democracy and freedoms for individuals. So I think that this collection is far better kept together and sold in toto rather than break it up.
Michael, is that what you'd like to say?
Yeah, it is much better in toto because, just as Tony described, it is literally a piece of those times and of the mind. And I'm thinking a collective mind sort of that was happening at the period. I've had this collection and enjoyed it for a long time, and I feel it belongs to humanity. The reverberations of what took place in San Francisco in the 60s continue to this very day. It changed society. What they did is, what the artists felt is that the existent institutions were confining them, keeping them in a cage, and they were willing to be themselves and do their own thing and make their own statements, regardless of the price they paid for it. And this freeing up began to spread to all the arts. It changed humor. The humorists were fighting the censors then, and they began using four-letter words, which landed them in jail previously. But it just opened up the whole thing, and the what's called then the sexual revolution, in which essentially people were freer to be themselves and to express their feelings toward others without having to go through the constraining braces that a society put upon them. But it didn't stop. It's like creation. Creation does not stop. This work, to me, it represented the ongoing creation. God rested on the seventh day, but there's no mention of what he did on the eighth. And I suspect on the eighth, I think we're still in his eighth day. And all that you see here are manifestations of the creative consciousness of the universe.
Now, there'll be people who wonder why all this work that was painted in California in the 50s and 60s is sitting in a gallery somewhere in Australia. How does this come to be?
After I retired to a very lovely hometown on the Gulf of Mexico, near Mobile Bay, where I was in the art scene, and then when I lost my wife, my daughter, very thoughtfully thought that I ought not be alone and live alone as I had been for about 6 years. I ought to be here where she can look after me and get my medical needs taken care of and so on and so forth. So she heroically came and moved me, packed me up and moved me to Melbourne, where she and her husband have lived for 25 or more years. But I brought my collection with me. And I've always hoped that someday I can really share it with the world, have the opportunity. And I looked around galleries to see where it might be appropriate and which gallery dealers might have the right feel for it. And I found Tony, who's just absolutely admirable to me. He's the consummate professional in working with art on all levels, and I won't take time to enumerate those. So it all worked out. It all came together as though guided by some cosmic time scale planning.
Well, that's lovely. I'm glad that the cosmos has brought us three together so that we could share it with the Radio National listener. Tony Lack, thank you for showing us over your gallery.
Thank you very much for coming, Michael. We very much enjoyed it.
And Mike, thank you for sharing your collection with us and, well, with the world.
And I want to thank you, Michael, for the wonderful hour upon hour upon hour of Radio National programs and book festival reviews that you've done over the years. I've enjoyed them immeasurably, and I'm a devoted follower.
Oh, what a kind man. That's the American art collector, Dr. Michael Agaron, whose collection is on show at the Ecliptic Gallery in Melbourne, and that's until this Sunday, the 15th of July. And we'll put a link to the gallery on our website, and that's where you can also see images of some of the paintings.